Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I stand before you today on the heels of a tremendous victory for our nation, our people, and our beloved Constitution.
At a rally this weekend, President Trump celebrated the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. The president called it a victory for our nation and our people. And last night, he apologized to Kavanaugh for what he and his family had gone through during the process.
What happened to the Kavanaugh family violates every notion of fairness, decency, and due process. Our country, a man or a woman, must always be presumed innocent unless and until proven guilty. And with that, I must state that you, sir, under historic scrutiny, were proven innocent.
To be clear, Kavanaugh was not proven innocent or guilty through any process, and there are many Americans who feel ignored and dismissed by the president. But what is clear is that the Kavanaugh nomination is the latest example of the fury, anger, and even contempt among not just our political leaders, but many Americans. People on both sides of the political spectrum are increasingly angry and distrusting of each other. And frankly, a lot of that is driven by pundits on social media and on cable news.
All the Democrats have is lying and deception, and this is all they have in the toolbox.
I want the Democrats to blitz every down, because that's what the Republicans do.
Screaming mobs of child activists scare normal people who are watching at home.
Local news covered rallies of women supporting Kavanaugh. Do they go out and support someone accused of murder or arson?
What are they going to run on? We're going to hike your taxes, we're going to take your health care and send your kids to a crap school? What's their campaign side for 2020 other than illegal immigrants, please vote for us?
So how did we get to a point where it feels like each side has such deep-seated contempt for the other, particularly around an issue as emotional and deeply personal as sexual harassment and assault? Liliana Mason is going to help us figure that out. She's an assistant professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland and the author of Uncivil Agreement: How Politics Became Our Identity. Liliana, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I really hope you can help us make some sense out of this, because I don't know if it's just me, but it feels as though contempt between Democrats and Republicans is perhaps at its highest point, or am I wrong?
Yeah, so in sort of the years that we have data for, which basically goes back to 1950, we have seen increases in dislike for the other party. So no matter which party you're in, you dislike the other party more. We've seen increases in levels of anger at the other party. And we've also seen increases in levels of enthusiasm for people's own party.
So this doesn't seem like a relationship that's really going to work out.
No. The part of the problem is that the parties are starting to feel very different from each other culturally and socially. And that really is driving a lot of this sense of sort of distance from each other.
Okay, all of us can sort of assume why we think this is happening, but what does your research show? What are some of these main issues that are leading to this intense animosity?
So the interesting thing that I've found is that it's not actually issues. It's really, really based in social identities. And so what happened was that during the 1970s and 80s, we had what political scientists call cross-cutting identities. So there were people who are in different parties but might go to the same church or might be neighbors. And what we've seen really since the 90s and early 2000s is that Democrats and Republicans have been sorting themselves into very, very socially different groups. So they tend to live in different neighborhoods. Democrats are generally the party of non-white people, while Republicans are the party of mostly white people. Republicans are mostly Christian. Democrats represent sort of everyone else. And increasingly, Republicans are more male, and the gender gap is growing between the parties. There's also cultural differences, geographical differences like rural and urban. And so over and over with all these different groups that people belong to, over the last few decades, it's become clearer to voters which party they belong in based on which social group they're already in.
So let's say that that's in fact the case. Do we have to be so contemptuous of each other? And last week when protesters confronted various senators in the hallways to really implore them to believe Christine Blasey Ford, for example, and other victims, there was a scene in which one protester confronted Senator Orrin Hatch.
Why aren't you brave enough to talk to us and exchange it with us? Don't you wave your hand at me. I wave my hand at you.
When you grow up, I'll be
right. When I you grow up,
we grow
you
up.
Not we grow
how
up.
Dare you talk to women that way? How dare you?
That first time? Right. How dare you?
They're yelling at him, and you hear angry protesters. And his response is, you know, and I'm quoting here, he says, when you grow up, I'd be glad to. And then he sort of waves them away. I'm wondering if we've lost the common bottom line when it comes to governance in terms of decency, at least the appearance that you are listening to other folks who may not be in your party.
So one really important thing that identity does for people is that it connects to their sense of self-esteem, which makes it extremely important that your group wins. Because if your group loses, you feel like you have personally lost, like there's a part of you that is now a loser. And what that means is that as our social identities become more related to our partisan identity, we're not really concerned about the policies that the government enacts as much as we are concerned about whether or not our team has won. And I liken it to something like sports team affiliation where, you know, everybody sits together and watches the Super Bowl. After the Super Bowl, nobody cares what the team does. They watch it to get that sense of victory, to feel really good from that victory. And when we have this sort of team-based us versus them kind of approach to governing, the voters increasingly are satisfied with the win and don't feel the need to pay attention to the actual policies that the government is legislating.
I'm wondering, I mean, pick an issue, any of the issues that we're seeing, and we see, you know, child separation at the border, right? So you could have strong opinions about immigration policy. You could have strong opinions about, you know, what our border policy should be. But what stuns me, and I think what stuns a lot of people, is just how disdainful and how cruel some of the attitudes towards what's happening, particularly to families and children, and in this case, sexual assault victims with Christine Blasey Ford. It just seems that there's a cruelty and a lack of humanity and understanding, even at face value.
Right. This is partly because when we have these social divides and when we become able to start dehumanizing the other side, it sort of becomes a battle over grievances. Who is the victim? And if the victim is the children in the detention centers, then you have one set of positions. But if the victim is, as the Republican Party really pushed, you know, young people that were murdered by immigrants. So all that has to happen is for each side to change the label of which side is the victim. The same thing happened with the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, right? It's either Ford is the victim or Kavanaugh is the victim. And the two sides are not really fighting over the same question. They're fighting over who gets to be the aggrieved side. By distilling it into this very simple win versus lose contest, we end up missing a lot of the more important details.
We're not going to therapy as a country. What do we do?
Hopefully we have some new realignment. I think that may be one of the only ways. Either we have a change in our electoral system that allows sort of minor parties to start having more power so that we have sort of less of a zero-sum game. Or, like what happened in 1964, we have a major rift in one party that creates more decades of cross-cutting identities that are new and slightly confusing, which actually creates less polarization and less us versus them.
Oh, you can't say the United States is a boring place. Liliana Mason is an assistant professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. Liliana, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.